is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The news from Nord Stream 1 and 2. Poland's prime minister, reads the Euro Observer, Mateusz Morawiecki, said the leaks in the Nord Stream pipelines were caused by sabotage. The quote, "Today we faced an act of sabotage. We don't know all the details of what happened, but we see clearly that it's an act of sabotage related to the next step of escalation of the situation in Ukraine." I go to a report in Defense One. Within these last hours, around noon local time on September 27th, Denmark's armed forces released footage of leaks in the Baltic Sea. And it wasn't just any leaks. Russia's Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipelines are leaking gas into the Baltic Sea. The day before, the 26th of September, Danish and Swedish government agencies had registered unexplained submarine explosions. Russia, it's becoming clear, is sabotaging its own pipelines. I'll stop there because I have not seen anything that proves that assertion. It's logical. However, in a whodunit, you wait for the detective. In this case, that would be Agatha Christie to tell you who did it. I only have Gregory Copley, who is my Agatha Christie for geopolitics. Gregory, a very good evening to you. We're headed to Russia. We're headed to Moscow, mobilization, annexation, escalation. But we must check off this Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 leak. As I understand it, they filled the pipelines with natural gas, not because they were shipping it, but because that's the way you keep them healthy while they're paused. And the natural gas is now leaking out of what is asserted to have been sabotage, perhaps with a submarine. I don't know. They don't give us a methodology. But this, again, is being directed at Russia. Without evidence, what is the significance that Poland is condemning for sabotage, that Denmark is condemning, that Sweden is condemning? Good evening to you, Gregory.
Good evening, John. Well, they would condemn Russia, wouldn't they? I mean, they've decided who the enemy is and have launched their attacks commensurately. Yes, as you say, there's no evidence as to what happened. Certainly something happened, and it's possible, even probable, that it was sabotage. The question is, by whom? The Russians had some time ago warned Germany that they would have to suspend operations on Nord Stream 1 to do essential maintenance. And yet that there was some restriction as though acceptance that that was in fact just a negotiating tactic by Moscow. But perhaps it was more than a negotiating tactic. Perhaps it was the truth that the pipeline needed some attention. Now, the question is, you've got Sweden, Denmark, Poland, who were not going to benefit really from the Nord Stream pipelines, particularly Nord Stream 2. So, you know, they had perhaps an interest in making sure that this was an embarrassing situation for Russia, making sure also that Germany could not go back on its decision to cease imports of Russian natural gas through the Nord Stream networks. So it's really ambiguous. Certainly, it doesn't do much good for East-West relations or for the prospect of getting enough energy into Western Europe for this coming winter. And that promises to be a winter of severe hardship because of the lack of energy, lack of planning, the lunacy of most Western European energy policies over the past decade and more.
I mentioned, Gregory, that I have some statistics from The Economist measuring the shortfall for this winter. So these are hard numbers. The estimate is that European Union will be 60 to 70 billion cubic meters short. No matter all resources, all storage, everything, they'll be that short. Next winter, it's worse. It's 140 billion cubic meters short. That's liquefied natural gas and natural gas in general. In other words, putting them together, because the LNG is coming in, although they don't have fixed ports, so they're bringing in mobile ports. They'll be 5 million barrels per day short, because that's the Russian oil that's coming by sea now that will be ended as of December 5th, is the plan. For refined oil, that is diesel, I don't have numbers, but the refined oil right now, the suggestion is that one way they can work around the shortages is to buy refined oil from China, China will buy crude oil from Russia. So it can be called petroleum laundering. Everybody's scrambling. So let's continue the chaos. In Italy, a new name, Giorgia Meloni, representing the Brothers of Italy party, which are headline writers are exhausting us all with references to Mussolini, someone who once upon a time led a failed Italy. I don't believe Ms. Meloni is looking to lead a failed Italy. She is, however, identified with nationalism on immigration and unknown about the Ukraine conflict. She has made remarks in the past that she supports the European Union. I mention it, Gregory, because I want your measure. There's a new government in Sweden, for example. I don't have all the details. There's a new government in London. These governments have to look out for their own. Is that contributing in any fashion to these doubts about getting through the winter?
Well, there is a growing hysteria on many fronts, not the least caused by the shortages of energy and the fact that certain governments, particularly the German government, have locked themselves into policies which will not allow them to go back heavily into fossil fuels or nuclear energy. Certainly France is trying to get some of its nuclear energy back on track, but their infrastructure is very old. The Germans aren't even trying that. They're restoring some brown coal, which are very dirty coal, brown coal refineries or power generation plants going, as well as other coal plants. But the reality is that there is no real policy at all. And then you have the European Union's foreign policy guru, Ms. Von der Leyen, who's basically making inflammatory statements about Russia. And the whole place is falling apart. And in the midst of this, you have, as you say, the Swedes and the Italians have just elected very conservative governments. Now, these conservative governments are maintaining their previous government's commitments on questions such as NATO and on European stability, but they are really the signs that the European Union itself is falling apart because it's been run now for the past couple of decades as literally a socialist gang trying to increase taxes, increase centralized controls and the like. And they're now facing the collapse of the euro. It's down on a par with the US dollar. They're facing massive energy shortages. They're facing massive inflation. They are likely to have major social problems over the next 6 to 12 months. So it's interesting. And of course, Giorgia Meloni is being called a fascist. There's absolutely nothing to support that. But we've seen in the United States and elsewhere that anybody who expresses any form of conservative opinion is called a fascist. So we have to take all of these stories with a grain of salt. Giorgia Meloni, in fact, seems to have extremely sensible policies in terms of economics and in terms of loosening the dependence on the European Union centralized controls. And I think that could be a step towards Italy moving away from the euro at some stage. You have to look at this as a situation where, for the first time since World War II, Italy has in fact achieved its own government, one which is not really under the thumb of either Washington or Brussels. So that's very profound. And you could make the same case in Sweden. This is the first time since, at least since World War II, that the Swedish government has been dominated by the conservative side of politics. This makes the very socialist core of the European Union and, of course, the Biden White House quake. So it's an interesting situation. Italy, I think, is going to make the right moves. And I think Britain, too, which no longer in the European Union, is taking very, very bold moves, which are causing panic in some of the financial markets. But these are the moves that are necessary to achieve the restoration of growth, both in Italy and in the UK and so on.
To Russia, mobilization, annexation, escalation. I could go on, protestation, the protests in the large cities, especially Moscow. the mobilization order. Right now, it's very inexact. We see videos coming out of London of young men being pushed into buses or joining in some way, said to be recruiting. It's all very difficult to know what is accurate and how it's presented. But in any event, the mobilization, is this logical for Putin to move to this after having presented the fact that he could do it without mobilization? And also about escalation, about annexation, the vote is underway in four oblasts. Is this logical for Putin to also go for annexing these parts of Ukraine before he's secured them on the ground?
Well, I think he's got sufficient dominance on the ground, particularly in the Donbass and Crimean area, that and that he knows that they're not going to go back on that, and that Russia has drawn the line in the sand. It's not going to go back from its claims, and it will prevail. I know everybody's talking about the tactical information about this battle and that battle and the losses of Russian battalions and Russian aircraft and so on and so on. All well and good. But the reality is Russia has the strategic depth to prevail. And that's what prevailed in World War II when the Axis powers put 3+ million troops in against Ukraine and Russia, and were eventually, after some real setbacks in Moscow, the Axis powers were pushed out of the Soviet space by the Russian and Russian Empire troops. So it's likely to happen again. Russia cannot afford not to prevail in this, and even if for some reason Putin wasn't there, I cannot imagine there being a Russian leader who would not attempt to solidify those claims, because if they give up now, they will never recover them, and Russia cannot afford to lose that control over the Black Sea and its access to warm waters.
And what we observe about the escalation, the question of nuclear weapons, you've never had any patience for that talk, Gregory. Has that changed in any fashion over these last days of tactical this and tactical that?
Well, the question is, what do you use a nuclear weapon for?
Right.
A nuclear weapon is just a big bang, and a very expensive one at that. And it has certain psychological things attached to it. So if you want to use them, then you better have a good goal in mind. Right now, there's no evidence that the use of a tactical or a strategic nuclear weapon would change the situation in any way other than cause a psychological disturbance in your adversary. So I think that it's much more likely that the U.S. would threaten at some stage in the near future to use tactical nuclear weapons, perhaps not directly in the Ukraine-Russia context, but possibly to even threaten that kind of retaliation if North Korea, for example, got out of hand. And that's important because now North Korea is very much part of the new Eurasian bloc, which is dominated by Beijing and Moscow.
Speaking with Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, we're turning to Iran, the turmoil there in these last days. I'm John Batchelor.